Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. One of the most iconic images from the aftermath of the Boston Marathon bombings is that of a stunned young man, his face blackened by smoke and debris, and certainly anguished. His right leg is missing, and he clutches his left as he's frantically wheeled off by a man in a cowboy hat. If not for the hat and for the man's racing bib, it could easily be mistaken for a combat photo. That image hit close to home in New Hampshire when it was revealed that the young man in the photo missing the leg was Jeff Bauman Jr., son of Concord resident Jeff Bauman Sr. The image took on new meanings from the horror of the day to representing kindness, hope, and help and resilience. In the latest issue of Yankee magazine, Mel Allen reflects on the goodness that prevailed a year ago. His article is called The Memories We Choose, and Mel is editor of Yankee magazine. Mel, welcome to the program.
It's really good to be here, Virginia. Thank you.
Well, let's start with that image. There were two versions of it, one carefully cropped that ran in newspapers online, the other showing more fully the real gore of what the blast did. I think we all recall seeing it. What do you think made it so memorable?
Well, there's so many things made it so memorable. One is that the cowboy hat, let's face it, there's a metaphor that we've all grown up with since we were children about the man or the woman in a white hat. Usually it's a man in the cowboy movies coming to the rescue. And here was this guy out of nowhere with a white hat, and he held this Jeff's life in the balance. And I think what made it so memorable is the aftermath, is that Jeff did live. And then he did become friends with his rescuer. And then we learned the story, the behind the story. And we all love heroic stories. And we learned that Carlos Arredondo, this Costa Rican immigrant, had lost his own two sons just over the last couple of years. And here he is with this incredible loss that he carries with him. And here he is saving a young man, basically the age of his sons. I think all that made it so memorable. And plus Jeff, not only did he live, but within his within all his pain was actually documented. The New York Times did a major photo feature of his rehabilitation. And then he would show up at Fenway Park, and then 35,000 people would be on their feet for him. So all this is wrapped up in the story of what good could come from such a horrific day.
Jeff Bauman actually also became the person who helped ID Tamerlan Tsarnaev. So many layers to this story.
Absolutely. And, you could say that Jeff, perhaps by IDing the brothers, maybe even saved other lives down the road, because as we all know, now they had plans to actually do more destruction in New York City.
We learned so many backstories that have given so much depth to the story of the Boston bombing. But your article is called The Memories We Choose. Can we look back at this time and not just remember the trauma? Can we really choose to do it differently?
That's a great question. I mean, I think we do. I think we always do. I'll use an example outside of the Boston bombing. Many of us, many of your listeners, will have lost loved ones. And we will have seen loved ones in the last days or weeks of their lives. And then when our loved ones, when they die, do we choose to remember them in their last week, or do we choose to remember them when they were healthy and when we had family functions together? And I think most of us choose in time to remember the happy moments. And in this case, it wasn't like I was writing about, let's choose happy moments. I was saying, why don't we choose to honor the victims of that day with the goodness that came from it, from strangers helping strangers, not by dignifying these two brothers and their cowardly act. Mm.
So which memories are you choosing? What stories are you bringing forward today?
Well, I'm choosing to remember the incredible impact that social media had with all these people, posting on Facebook and Twitter and so on, saying, I will come pick you up. Tell me where you are. My house is available to you. I choose to remember the incredible the expertise and the heroism of the medical teams that were called into the same kind of duty that Army hospitals are. And, the families of the three people who died they will be touched by this event for the rest of their lives. Their lives will never be the same. We all know that. The lives of people who lost limbs and horrific injuries, their lives will never be the same. However, we remember, and I'm choosing to remember, the hundreds of people whose lives were saved. Mm-hmm. I'm choosing to remember the people whose injuries could have been so much worse had they not been treated so fast. I'm choosing to remember that the total strangers who rushed into the smoke, into the chaos to help other people. And that's just, it is a conscious choice. It's not an accident that a young woman the other day on Meet the Press said, do not mention the names of these two brothers who did this act. And that was her choice. They did mention it, and she was very upset with that. Mm. But she has made the choice not to say their names.
Well, Mel, you've been with Yankee Magazine for more than 30 years. Now, you've thought a lot about New England and how it functions. Tell us a little bit about the place that the Boston Marathon holds in the identity of New England and why it mattered so much that the Bombers chose this event.
Well, that's a great question. I think obviously one thing is just the sheer longevity of the Boston Marathon. You know, we are a region so steeped in history, and here is this athletic event that is just as steeped in history as the region. Secondly, it always comes on Patriots Day. It always comes basically with the first days of spring. So we are all linked together with a historic event with Patriots Day, with Lexington and Concord and all that, and also usually the first warm days. And the Red Sox are playing at 11 o'clock in the morning. So it's more almost like a regional holiday, all happening at once. And then it's a sporting event where we, the public, can get so close to the athletes. It's not like a football game where you're sitting, you know, 50 yards, 100 yards away on some upper top bleacher thing. You are almost can touch the runners as they go by. So it's all these concrete, tangible things rolled into this one event. And let's face it, Boston Marathon does represent resilience and endurance and people training, people who are friends that we know from work or our own family members, and we're coming to support them. It's all rolled into this one 3 or 4 or 5 hour event. And I think when something horrific happens, it's almost like as if you're home. Someone has come and destroyed your home for a while.
Well, you just brought it to life for me, certainly. Somebody who has been so moved to watch the marathons. But let's talk about how that translates to how we experience tragedy. You know, it's a regional holiday for us when the Boston Marathon and Patriots Day happen. How about a regional as compact as New England and how we experience tragedy?
Yeah, you put your finger on it. There is no other region in America as compact as New England. So when you have something happen in Boston, even if you live in Connecticut or if you live in New Hampshire or if you live in Vermont, with the exception of northernmost Maine, everybody in New England is within 2 or 3 hours of this event. I'm guessing very few people have not actually been on Boylston Street. I'm sure there's very few people who have not kind of strolled, you know, Commonwealth Avenue where the runners go and so on. So when it happens in a region as compact as New England, it happens to all of us. And there's no other region in the country that even comes close to sharing that unity of feeling.
I wonder if it even has more significance after such a long, difficult, snow-laden winter here in New England.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think the marathon that's going to happen next week is probably going to be the most attended, the most watched, and probably going to be the marathon by which we judge all other marathons after this.
Mel Allen, thank you so much for for helping us choose differently today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Mel Allen, editor of Yankee Magazine. His article called The Memories We Choose can be found in the most recent issue of Yankee. It's also on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Among the good things Mel Allen encouraged us to remember in his article is the dedication of Dr. David King. He's a trauma surgeon at Mass General Hospital and veteran of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Dr. King was heading home after finishing the marathon himself when he heard news of the blasts and immediately turned around and headed into the chaos to treat the victims. Here he is sharing his story with the WBUR Oral History Project.
In front of the hospital, it looked the same as any other day, not particularly crowded, not particularly empty. Walked into the trauma center in the emergency department. The first wave of patients had arrived. There were only 5 or 6 or something like that. But the curtains were open to the trauma bays. and I could see two or three of them, and that was the moment that I knew it wasn't a kitchen fire or a manhole explosion or something like that. It was clearly some kind of improvised explosive device. It was a pattern of injury that I could see from 20 feet away that I had seen 1,000 times in Iraq and Afghanistan. And within about 2 or 3 minutes of arriving in the emergency room, I was taking one of the first patients to the operating room. Our decade of war experience has taught us a lot of lessons that now have largely become standard of care. In the past, we used to perform one big, long operation that fixed everything that was wrong with them. We recognize now that that's probably not the right approach. Instead, what we do, the first operation is meant to just stop bleeding and control infection, usually a very short operation. Then we send those patients back to the intensive care unit for a day or two. Then we bring them back to the operating room and we do a little bit more, and they go back to the ICU and so on. You know, some patients recovering faster than others, some patients taking months before they were discharged from the hospital. Certainly one of the highlights of our week at Mass General was President Obama's visit. Some might argue that having a presidential visit could be a distraction in the middle of trying to manage all of these casualties and their multiple trips to the operating room, but it did fairly remarkable things for their psychological outcomes and their coping. You know, this occurred on Thursday. The bombing was Monday. I'd seen all these patients every day, several times a day, all week long. And, you know, I can think of individual patients who honestly hadn't cracked a smile all week, who were beaming from earlobe to earlobe.
That marathon reflection was produced by Kelly Horan for the WBUR Oral History Project in collaboration with Northeastern University's Our Marathon, Boston Bombing Digital Archive. Oral historian Jane Guberman conducted the King interview. You'll find links to browse through and listen to a number of other firsthand stories from the archives at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last night, the peepers were a chorus of yearning from the pond near my house. It is a welcome sound of spring and of the natural world doing its thing, far from the sirens and horns of urban centers, and a world apart from Facebook updates, YouTube videos, and political shouting matches on TV. Finding an escape from the noise is, as it turns out, kind of pricey. Chloe Shama is a story editor at New Republic, and she observes the proliferation of near-silent luxury cars, noise-canceling headphones, and the growing popularity of silent retreats in an article for the New Republic called Silence is Now a Luxury. Chloe Shama, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
The ordinances against noise, as you discovered, are not a new thing. How have societies tried to control or escape noise in the past?
No, they're not new. They go back to at least the early part of the 20th century, but you know, the noise as a concern has been around for much, much longer than that. In fact, you could trace it back even to ancient times, and I think I make one mention in my piece about a specific noise restriction that was issued in Elizabethan England, in which men were not allowed to beat their wives after a certain time in the evening because of noise concerns rather than any other concerns. But noise ordinances, as we think of them today, kind of as municipal or governmental regulations, do date back to at least 100 years ago. New York City, in particular, has been seen as kind of at the forefront of noise regulation and noise control, I think probably due to the density of the people living there, and there have been many studies and books written about how residents and the government of New York City has tried to control noise.
I think of the migration away from cities to the suburbs in the 20th century, you know, people who were overloaded with industrial urbanity seeking grass and quiet and trees. Has it been traditionally associated with money and class?
The desire to get away from noise, I think, is probably actually something that transcends class. The kind of interesting component of that desire or the response to that desire that I was trying to get at is that there seem to be more and more options for people who do have a lot of disposable income and fewer options for those who don't have a lot of disposable income.
This is something you illustrate now with Amtrak's quiet car, you know, where there are no cell phone conversations allowed. You found also that people are willing to pay premiums for silent flights, something that has not yet been tested, but sounds like there may be a good market for it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Amtrak is sort of unique among the phenomena that I was charting in that you don't actually have to pay any extra to sit in the quiet car. But there are studies that have shown that people would be potentially interested in paying a little bit more to be in, for instance, a section of an airplane where people are not able to speak on their cell phones. And I think this was particularly on people's minds a few months ago when the FAA announced that they were going to at least potentially allow that. I'm not exactly sure where it stands immediately, but opened up the possibility that we would all be soon on flights where people were chatting on their phones.
There are also a number of other travel options for those who are seeking silence. Tell us about this proliferation or the popularity of people who are seeking silence.
Yes, it's true. So silent retreats have obviously been around for a long time and are, you know, part of many meditative practices and, you know, some Buddhist practices, I believe, as well. So there's nothing new particularly. But what I found was that these retreats are at least gaining increased media attention, if not, you know, explicitly multiplying in number and availability. There was actually a great New York Times article, I think about a year ago, about a retreat in, I believe it's Arizona, where people are actually on a silent retreat that lasts a number of years. I think it's 3 years. So, you know, people are not only going on these with increased frequency, but extending them for longer periods of time.
You also found a series of travel photography books aiming to get tourists to the quietest spots in various cities and an iPhone app called Stereo Public that identifies placid urban spaces, encouraging ear witnesses to map these locales. And you also numbered a number of luxury products that are selling silence. What are some of these?
Well, the most obvious one that comes to mind are noise-canceling headphones, which have been around for, I guess it's, you know, close to 15 or 20 years, but they're also increasing marketing surrounding cars and vacuum cleaners and I think even hair dryers, where they're advertised as being the quietest on the market. And, you know, these things are generally more expensive than your average vacuum cleaner.
Right. The Bosch dishwasher sells for about $1,700. That says it's
right.
The quietest dishwasher. Well, I noticed a no cell phone policy recently on a bus trip. You know, the coach lines are trying to bring themselves up market from the bus lines of old. What do you think is behind this kind of commodification of silence? What are we seeking and why are we willing to pay for it?
I do think there are a couple of things you can look at as potentially interesting explanations. One is just the proliferation of media that we all encounter in our daily lives. And, you know, I'm certainly not the first to point this out, but from the moment we wake up, we check our phones and we check our email. And if you're on social media, you've perhaps received alerts overnight from Facebook or Twitter. And a lot of people I spoke to actually likened this kind of irritation from technology to noise and kind of expanded the idea of noise as irritation more broadly speaking. And so you can see the kind of turn towards silence as a response to this noise in a broad sense. Another reason that's possible is that historically, noise has been a greater concern in times of relative prosperity. You can look at it perhaps as a response to the feeling that we're somewhat in the clear from at least major economic turmoil and therefore able to look at things that perhaps affect our quality of life more than our actual livelihood.
What do we know about what constantly being exposed to noise actually does to human beings?
The people who study noise pollution actually found some kind of really horrifying things about noise. There was a quite famous World Health Organization report that made an estimate based on what they call disability-adjusted years that at least 1 million healthy life years, as they call them, are lost every year from traffic-related noise alone. So I believe that this traffic-related noise included air traffic, which is a huge complaint of people who live under flight paths. And I think also particularly for children, this is being seen to be a problem. There's another study that I cite in which children who are exposed to chronic aircraft noise have more difficulty reading and have worse long-term memory. So, you know, there are definitive drawbacks. So it's not, the concern about silence is not just a frivolous one. It is connected to real, in some instances, life-threatening issues.
Chloe Shama, story editor for The New Republic, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Chloe wrote about the quiet carization of America in an article for The New Republic. It's called Silence is Now a Luxury Product. We have a link for you to read it quietly yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Does the thought of reading poetry make you want to head for the hills? A contemporary poet tries to convince you otherwise. When Word of Mouth continues, poetry for people who hate poetry.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
Mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and April is National Poetry Month. But let's face it, there are a lot of people out there who just are not interested in reading or listening or talking about poetry. Otherwise, average readers who are, for whatever reason, simply averse to verse. Well, we're going to see if we can change that. Victoria Chang is a poet, most recently of a collection called The Boss. She recently compiled for Huffington Post a list called 13 Poetry Collections for People Who Think They Don't Like Poetry. Victoria, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why do you think it is that poetry repels so many readers, many of whom probably haven't even given it a chance?
You know, I think it really starts in high school. And I think that, you know, a lot of English teachers in high school, they're approaching it from a very academic standpoint. And I think that that continues, that sort of initially turns, you know, kids off, and then they never return to it. And then a lot of the verse being published today, I think, is so much entrenched in academia, it's almost like poets are writing poems just for each other and writing books just for each other. And it really alienates, I think, the rest of the world. And then it's just hard to return to that entry point now with so many different media outlets and other things that, you know, kids can go back to, like video games or the internet. And I just think it's hard to, you know, come back at it.
So you've compiled this list for those to dip their toe back in. First mm-hmm. poet on your list, Billy Collins, who you say is probably the best introduction to poetry for people who don't like poetry. Why so?
Well, it's just so accessible. And I think, you know, you often hear this when you talk to people who don't read poetry or aren't interested in it. It's just, they always say that it's just too hard. I think Billy Collins is that, you know, I call him the king of approachable and accessible poetry because he writes in a way that just, it almost feels like you're reading a newspaper or something, but that, you know, really easy. You don't have to, your mind doesn't get stuck a lot. You just kind of flows and your eye just moves as if you're reading fiction or an easy newspaper article. But you know, he writes about things that are a little bit deeper. And I think that that makes him a great place to start. And, you know, he's known for that, being sort of that accessible yet actually well-respected poet, even amongst, you know, academic poets.
Here is Billy Collins reading The Best Cigarette from his collection Sailing Alone Around the Room.
The Best Cigarette. There are many that I miss, having sent my last one out a car window, sparking along the road one night years ago. The heralded ones, of course, after sex, the two glowing tips now the lights of a single ship, at the end of a long dinner with more wine to come and a smoke ring coasting into the chandelier, or on a white beach holding one with fingers still wet from a swim. How bittersweet these punctuations of flame and gesture. But the best were on those mornings when I would have a little something going in the typewriter.
Billy Collins reading the poem The Best Cigarette. That's from his collection Sailing Alone Around the Room. Victoria Chang, how do you suggest readers take in a collection of poetry? Maybe just try one or two at a time, or do you read it like you might a novel?
Well, gosh, you know, I think you can read it any way you want. Some people start from the beginning to the end. I used to do that, and because I used to think that, well, that's how the poet wanted you to read them, this collection of poems. And then I heard some other poets, just like Robert Haas is the poet in California, and he just tosses his poems up into the air and they land where they land. And so now when I read a book of poems, I don't even read the whole thing, and books can sit on my desk for years, and I'll just take one poem and just read it once in a while. Oh, I'll just read one poem before I go to bed, or you know, maybe I'll read this other poem a year later. It to me now, it's kind of just whatever you feel like, however you feel. And I think the internet and the advent of all this new technology has sort of changed how we receive books, even especially books like poetry that don't necessarily need to be read like a straight narrative.
There are some collections here that are newer collections, some older collections. Lucille Clifton, Louise Glick is on the list, Frederick Seidel, a New York poet, very interesting one. Another poet on your list is Sharon Olds, who lives at least part-time here in New Hampshire, and I spoke to her last year about her collection Stag's Leap. She read the poem for which the book is named. Here is an excerpt.
I feel like his victim, and he seems my victim. I worry that the outstretched legs on the heart are bent the wrong way as he throws himself off. Oh, my mate, I was vain of his faithfulness, as if it was a compliment rather than a state of partial sleep. And when I wrote about him, did he feel he had to walk around carrying my books on his head like a stack of posture volumes, or the rack of horns hung where a hunter washes the venison down with the Sauvignon?
Sharon Olds reading from her poem Stag's Leap. That's from a collection of the same name. That collection largely about her divorce, extremely personal. You have another suggestion for someone who would be new to poetry to get to know Sharon Olds. What's your suggestion?
It's a book called Gold Cell, and it's, I think a lot of poets, practicing poets, often refer to Gold Cell as one of their favorite Sharon Olds books. And yeah, you know, it's, I think all of her books are very similar, and I know poets probably hate to hear that, but you know, I think a lot of poets sort of focus on and have the same obsessions, and they might differ a little bit, but you know, I think we all kind of are concerned about what we're concerned about, and it's hard for that not to come through in the art form. But yeah, Gold Cell for me was one of the first poetry books that I bought, and it still sits, you know, in my book, on my bookshelf, and it was so precious to me that I actually wrapped it in contact paper. And so, yeah, it was just so, it was such a riveting entry into the poetry world, because like Stag's Leap, you're reading it and it's almost, wow, that's just amazing that she can feel so comfortable writing about such personal things yet not turn the reader off. And I have had many relationships that have ended. So you sort of feel that universality, even though she's so incredibly personal and honest. It's quite searing, actually.
Victoria Chang is with us. She's a poet who's written an article about some poetry books and collections for people who don't think that they really like poetry. Also on your list is The Half-Finished Heaven by Nobel Prize winner Thomas Tranströmer. I hope I'm saying that properly. Tell us a little bit about his work and what makes that worth reading for the poetry skeptic.
Well, Tranströmer's just this lovely poet that a lot of Americans have translated, and he just has this incredibly macro perspective and of what sort of why we're here, and these greater kind of existential questions that I always find so interesting. Towards the end, I feel like he ends his poem so beautifully. I think in one poem he describes a newspaper like a dirty butterfly. And I always remember that image. I was thinking, who thinks of a newspaper as a dirty butterfly? And, you know, he does that again and again in all of his poems, but especially in that collection I really enjoy.
Well, you talked about tackling big existential questions, which may be precisely why people don't engage in poetry. It's frightening for them. And
right.
Humor may be one of the best ways of winning over the poetry skeptic. And you suggest a collection that's pretty funny, although often quite shocking. It's called Letters to Wendy's. Can you tell us a little bit about this collection?
Oh, right. Yeah, Letters to Wendy's is written by a poet named Joe Wenderos, who published this book a while ago. But when it came onto the scene and the world, actually, people really, it was shocking because, you know, he uses, it's almost, it does border on pornographic, but it's so brilliant because he uses the metaphor of Wendy's, the fast food restaurant, which we've all been to, you know, with the Biggies and the Frosties and that red-headed Wendy's that stares at you with this blue and white striped dress. I mean, think of how rich or a minefield potentially all of these images could be in this collection of poems that he supposedly had written over a year on comment cards, you know, sitting at the fast food chain. And they're all these kind of prose poems, you know, just kind of loose little blocks of language, and it just you can read those and you'll just be laughing out loud.
Well, we found a couple of the most innocent selections in the book and had our producer Zach Nugent read a couple entries. Here he is.
January 3rd, 1997. I've been sort of hesitant to mention this, but I believe one of your employees, you must know the one I speak of, is a beaver. It's impossible to look into her face, to hear the sounds she makes, and to see the way she moves, the way she carries bits of wood, and not feel that this is a beaver. I've not mentioned this before because, obviously, beavers are powerful creatures.
Producer Zach Nugent there reading from Letters to Wendy's. So these are all collections that you would recommend for the poetry novice. Any that you would suggest they avoid?
I tend to avoid personally anything that feels too overly sentimental, too cliched. And, you know, I think for me, you know, a lot of poetry professors and teachers are always saying, read, you know, old collections, you know, things from a long, long time ago. And honestly, I've never loved really old poetry. And I know people recommend Emily Dickinson and all this kind of stuff, but I've never loved that kind of poetry. I like things that are more current, you know, maybe the last 20 or 30 years max. And especially for people who don't read poetry regularly, I would say, you know, you can just read current stuff and it'll be more applicable to your daily life.
Well, Victoria, while we have you on the line, April 15th has come to have different significance for people as the anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings. Any recommendations for us for poems for an occasion like this?
You know, I actually think that there's a book by Bob Hickok, mm-hmm. you know, it's called Elegy Ode, and it talks a lot about death, and, you know, and he's really... really accessible, and he's really funny. You know, that's a definite possibility as something to read. And, you know, The Rose by Lee Young Lee, it talks a lot about family and love, and it's very soft and gentle, and it's kind of like a warm hot cup of hot chocolate, you know. But it's also kind of sad at the same time. So I think that there's books like that would definitely have that feeling of comfort. And then there's a book by Donald Hall. He wrote this great book called Without.
Mm-hmm. After Jane Kenyon, his wife, died.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's just a beautiful book. And he's very easy to read and is very sort of well known amongst non-poets, too, I think. And Jane Kenyon, there's a great example of really simple, short, easy to read poems that are so impactful. You know, her poems are a lot about sort of death, and but they're just uplifting at the same time.
Victoria Chang, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Victoria Chang is a poet, and her most recent book called The Boss was published by McSweeney's last year. You'll find a link to read her full list of poetry collections for people who do not like poetry. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Now, we understand that poetry can be a little intimidating for the uninitiated or those who just plain don't like it. That's why we're celebrating National Poetry Month with a low-stakes challenge, asking listeners to create and send in their own original haikus about public radio. So, first a refresher. A haiku is composed of three lines. First line, 5 syllables. Second line, 7 syllables. Third line, 5 syllables. In case you need a little inspiration, here is a submission from Julie to get you started. Baby in the car, chanting the toll-free number, making pledge time fun. You can share your own public radio haiku on our Facebook page or on Twitter at Word of Mouth. And don't forget to use the hashtag Radio Haiku. There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. That sound from a tribute ceremony held earlier today at the Heinz Convention Center in Boston to commemorate the Boston Marathon bombings 1 year ago. The two explosions left three people dead and more than 260 critically injured, plunging a beloved Boston event into chaos. We're going to join those across the nation in observing a moment of silence at 2:49 p.m., the time that the first blast occurred. And our thoughts today are with the families of those killed, with those injured by the blasts, with the first responders and the courageous and helpful bystanders, and of course to a city and a nation affected by the Boston bombings. On days like this, we look for reasons to hope. And I can think of few events that fill my heart with more optimism than the annual Poetry Out Loud State Finals held at the State House here in Concord. High school students from around the state memorize and bring their favorite poems to life in front of a live audience. April being National Poetry Month, we are bringing a taste of the event directly to you.
I'm Aaliyah Brown. I'm a junior at John Stark Regional High School, and I will be reciting La Belle Dame Sans Merci by John Keats. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, alone and palely loitering? The sedge has withered from the lake, and no birds sing. Oh, what can ail thee, knight at arms, so haggard and so woebegone? The squirrel's granary is full, and the harvest done. I see a lily on thy brow, with anguish moist in fever dew, and on thy cheeks a fading rose fast withereth too. I met a lady in the meads, full beautiful, a fairy's child. Her hair was long, her foot was light, and her eyes were wild. I made a garland for her head, and bracelets too, and fragrance sewn. She looked at me as she did love, and made sweet moan. I set her on my pacing steed, and nothing else saw all day long, for sidelong would she bend and sing a fairy song. She found me roots of relish sweet, and honey wild and manna dew, and sure in language strange she said, I love thee true. She took me to her elfin grot, and there she wept and sighed full sore. And there I shut her wild, wild eyes with kisses four. And there she lulled me asleep. And there I dreamed. Ah! Woe betide the latest dream I ever dreamt on the cold hill's side. I saw pale kings and princes too, pale warriors, death pale were they all, and they cried, La Belle Dame Sans Merci thee hath in thrall. I saw their starved lips in the gloam, with horrid warning gaped wide. And I awoke and found me here on the cold hillside. And this is why I sojourn here, alone and palely loitering, though the sedge is withered from the lake and no birds sing.
You'll find a link to watch the state finals competition online, along with more on how your school can become involved with Poetry Out Loud at wordofmouthradio.org. And we end today's show by looking back at a specific moment in the life of a young poet before he became famous. That's when 28-year-old Allen Ginsberg stood up and publicly read his poem Howl for the very first time. Producer Paul McDonald has the story.
A couple of years ago, I read a magazine article by someone who felt that poetry was dead and no one really cared. It is a sentiment I hear on occasion, and every time I hear it, I have to restrain myself to keep from laughing. Maybe poetry doesn't necessarily happen in a particular form that someone thinks it should, but poetry is an art form that defies convention. Case in point, October 7th, 1955. A date, depending on who you talk to, that's either historical or infamous. This was the night of a poetry reading at the Six Gallery in San Francisco. Among the poets reading were Gary Snyder, Michael McClure, and Allen Ginsberg. Also present was an inebriated Jack Kerouac who made sure everyone had wine and shouted out the word go after every line recited. The centerpiece of the evening was Allen Ginsberg's first public reading of his poem Howl, which shocked everyone with its fury and candor. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, publisher of City Lights Books, would later be jailed for publishing Ginsberg's poem, which is now routinely taught in college literature courses. That evening was a link in a long chain of events that eventually mushroomed into a full-blown counterculture that literally changed the world. While I'm sure this may not have been on the agenda for the evening, it illustrates just how powerful and combustible poetry can be. The readers at the Six Gallery didn't start anything new. They drew upon the traditions of their elders such as Walt Whitman, William Carlos Williams, and Charles Olson. They inspired another generation of poets, writers, and musicians such as Bob Dylan, Gil Scott-Heron, and Leonard Cohen, who in turn inspired Bruce Springsteen to point the way to Thunder Road, Kurt Cobain to tell us about feeling stupid and contagious, and 3-6 Mafia to articulate just how hard it is out here for a pimp. Poetry happens. It's just a plain fact of life. It might not appear in a form you're accustomed to, but it's just as alive, essential, and wild as it always has been.
Our thanks to producer Paul McDonald for that piece. Thank you for joining us today as we considered memory, tragedy, and poetry. I'm reminded today of a few lines from William Carlos Williams' poem, Asphodel, that greeny flower, in which he writes, "It is difficult to get the news from poems, yet men die every day for lack of what is found there." We do hope that you will find plenty of life-affirming things to think about today. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you to join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.